Accession number 8736 from number 11.
Lord Harding, tape 11. I wonder if you could tell me a little more about Montgomery's teaching methods. You know, regarding the content, did you find him very progressive at that time, his ideas?
Oh, yes, very much so, I think. he devoted himself to a study of the conduct of war, and he continued that study right up to the time at the beginning of the Second World War, so that by study and reading of history and understanding of the qualities required for command and the relationships between commanders and staffs and how command would be best exercised, and particularly on the personal side, that's getting to understand and know the troops and be able to talk to them, be able to explain to them why they were being required to do what was needed and to make put their lives at risk and make necessary sacrifice if necessary. Well, I think he was brilliant at it, and I think he taught the whole British Army a great deal about command and about staff work too, and about the relationships between commanders and their troops, and about studying the personality and the qualities and the attitudes of the opposing commander. I mean, he had a picture, a photograph of Rommel in his caravan, and all that sort of thing, bringing the conduct of war up to the requirements of that age and generation. And I don't know, I think he was a brilliant teacher, and then became, of course, a brilliant leader. He was, criticized him more for what the way he behaved and the attitudes he took up after the Second World War than during it. And he became, perhaps he was inclined to think he knew the answers to everything, and made the mistake of pontificating about all sorts of issues and problems that he really didn't know about enough about or understand. And that's why I think he was mostly the criticism. There are some people who criticized him, some of his commanders, some people who served under him, because he didn't suffer fools gladly. And he was very demanding in standards, and particularly standards of efficiency and standards of command and staff work. And that, I think, was the basis of criticism. But most of the people that I know who were most critical of him probably deserved the criticism that they got.
It's interesting what you were saying about his emphasis on the relationships between officers and men, as well as the other layers, because you have hinted at this yourself, haven't you, how important it was. Were you beginning to realise that the men had some sort of responsibility for thinking through problems at that time, as well as just obeying orders?
I think this sort of gradually emerged from my experience of command at various levels during this First World War, and then between the wars during the training periods. Put it in a nutshell, if you want people to put their lives at risk, you've got to convince them that what they require are being asked to do is something that is important and worthwhile and something within their capabilities. In other words, you've got to do two things. You've got to convince them that their cause is right. I mean, not necessarily their overall political and moral cause, but their technical, the reason for carrying out an attack in a difficult circumstances and the risk of heavy losses. And you've got to make sure, the other thing you've got to do is to make quite certain that they've got all the support that can possibly be given to them in order to reduce the risks both of failure and of excessive casualties. And casualties are inevitable in any combat, in any battle. But what you must do is you've got to carry them with you, and you've got to do that. You've got to satisfy them with what they're being asked to do, or required to do, is essential and important, and that they're given the optimum chance of being successful. And that is the responsibility of any commander. And Monty, I think, taught us that, and he was a living example of how it should be done. Before the Battle of El Alamein, he went round to each division in turn and had a meeting, a gathering of all the officers of a division or a corps or a brigade and explained to them what he was asking of them and why and what he expected to happen. And that that is a very important thing, and that's something you've learned from him, and which I hope that I have been able to carry out ever since in the responsibilities that I've had. Well, we had to carry the pipes up. It was in Waziristan, and they were building a road and a pipe water pipeline.
This is when you were in India, I think. You're telling this story of when you worked with your men.
Yes. So it was in 1940, I suppose, when I was commanding the 1st Battalion of my regiment. And our job was to, three jobs really we had. One was to picket the heights, cover the construction of the road, to help with the construction of the road by pushing stones and rocks and boulders about and that sort of thing, and to carry the pipes up for the construction of this pipeline. And it was a three-man load, a pipe was a three-man load, with one man at each end and another one in the middle. I had an adjutant and a regimental sergeant major who were both taller than me. So I said, well, come on, we better take our turn in this, and you, Tony Hunt, the adjutant, would take one end, George Farmer, the regimental sergeant, would take the other, and I'll walk in the middle. And so we carried up, and it was a very little burden for me because they were both a good deal taller than me, so they carried the weight and I walked in the middle. But the troops saw what was happening, and I suppose it helped, you know, to think that, well, we're all in it together. The whole thing you've got to do is to make clear that the top brass, the staff, the troops, everybody, you're all in it together, and you're all concerned with the result and the action. And that is something which you learn by experience that you've got to do. Monty was a great example, a teacher in this respect.
What was he like as a man? You know, was he a friendly personality? Did you find him easy to get on with?
Well, I wouldn't call him an example. My wife got very, very fond of him. She thought he was very lonely. And I think he was lonely in the sense that any high commander is lonely. You see, he lost his wife. His son, David, he didn't see very much of. And they hadn't got to know each other well during the boy's upgoing. He was at school when Monty was mixed up in the war. And Monty relied on his schoolmaster and his wife to look after him during the holidays. So he was, yes, he was rather a learned man, and he had a reputation, of course, of being, well, put it mildly, a bit ill-mannered in dealing with people. And the story was that he was asked to, if visiting somewhere and staying with a local commander, and had a dinner party after dinner when he was sad, he said, well, I'm off to bed, good night. And I remember my wife saying, well, he won't behave like that when he comes to stay with us. I won't have it. But he didn't. And no, he was. He had a rooster streak in him, of course. Everybody who plans or attempts to exercise high command must have a rooster streak, and you must be able to make up your mind that you won't go on with people who don't do their job fully and properly to your satisfaction. And this is one of the problems and difficulties of high command. But no, he got a reputation for being well, perhaps self-centered to some extent. But and also lacking in compassion. But I dispute the latter one, because after I'd been wounded, I was in the hospital outside Cairo, and the doctors had written me off. They said I wouldn't do another active job. And Monty came down. He was planning the invasion of Sicily. And I got a message to say that he would like to come out and see me, and when would it be convenient? So I told the hospital people, I said, well, as far as I'm concerned, I just lie here on my back, so any time of the day is convenient to me, and I'd be delighted to see him. But, you know, I thought that he would come and perhaps pass the time of day and say, hello, John, how are you? And how are you getting on? And what's the future? And so on. Not a bit of it. He came. He pulled up a chair beside my bed. He sent his ADC away to do some job for him. And he spent the best part of an hour, maybe more than an hour, telling me all that had happened since I was knocked out, and about his plans for the future, with particular reference to my old division, which, of course, was of immense interest and to me. And then after that, he kept in touch with me, and I'll show you some letters that I had from him, which he said, well, when you hurry up and get fit, and when you're fit, you can have the best job in my army. So I said that he wasn't lacking in compassion. People say, oh, well, John, he knew that he was going to get good value from you. But I don't agree. I think he didn't suffer fools gladly, but people in whom he had confidence and in whom he believed were good at their job, he would look after. And he did look after me very well. And if you read Nigel Hamilton's second volume, you'll see that that on one occasion, when I was in Italy, chief of staff, Bookie, who was then CIDS, thought that Alex wasn't getting on as well as he ought to be with the armies in Italy. And had he got to ask Monty, what about the chief of staff? That's me. And Monty replied, oh no, Harding is first class. Well, you'll find that in Nigel Hamilton's book. But no, he was very good to me. And I mean, I'll show you a book which he wrote. The copies of Alamein to the Sangreal, which his first book about the war, and his part, Alamein, in which is written in the front to me, having been someone who made some contribution to the success of it. Well, that is a great treasured possession of mine. Well, now, maybe I was fortunate, and he thought I was not too bad at my job. He looked after me.
Did he have any firm ideas at that time in the 1930s at Staff College about the importance of, say, mechanisation? Was he sort of progressive
I don't remember anything in particular about that, but he was forward-looking, and he clearly realised that the land forces were going through a period of transition from being vehicles and being dependent on horse-drawn transport, horse-drawn artillery, into mechanised artillery. Now, I don't know. I don't remember any particular emphasis that he placed on the mechanisation of the army. But undoubtedly, I'm quite sure that he was the protagonist of progression in that progress in that direction.
How about O'Connor? You mentioned he was a tutor as well.
He was a teacher. He was a brilliant teacher too. He's a very much quieter, more unambitious. Monty, of course, was intensely ambitious. And I suppose a great egoist. But Dick O'Connor was a much more modest, self-effacing almost individual. But he was a very good teacher. He taught us staff work, primarily, of which he was very good. And then, of course, I got to know him. Well, we got to know each other very well during those 2 years. And later on, in the desert, he asked for me to take over as his DGS, it was called, when he was commanding Western Desert Force in the first campaign against the Italians, which I did. And I got to know him very well and had tremendous confidence and affection for him. He was a great commander, and if he hadn't been captured and been a prisoner of war for some considerable time, I'm quite sure that he would have made a very, very important mark for himself in the campaign in Northwest Europe. As it was, he was commanding a corps. He had been a prisoner of war. And in my experience, anyone who's been through a period of being a prisoner of war is affected. And according to Pitt Roberts, who was one of his divisional commanders then, who had been my brigade, armored brigade commander when I was commanding the 7th Division, is that he had lost some of his decisiveness as a result of being a prisoner of war. Well, that I think is completely understandable. But I've got tremendous, greatest admiration for Dick O'Connor, for him as a teacher and for him as a commander.
I think you mentioned that Templar also was, General Templar yes. was in your group at this time.
Yes, he was, yes. he wasn't, I don't think that any of us were, certainly. I don't think if you'd asked the general if he's still alive, who was outstanding during our term in the South College, he wouldn't name anybody in particular. He might name Dick McCreary, he might name somebody else. But as I told you, in those days, you people were nothing like as rank conscious or career conscious as the professional army is of today. But we were good friends. I whipped into the drag, Gerald was assistant secretary to the drag. We got to know each other very well, our wives met, and that sort of thing.
What is this drag when you refer about?
Drag is a drag hunt. A hunt with hounds without a fox. Where you have somebody, a runner, who drags a lot of rag, which is soaked in fox droppings and dung and aniseed, and that runs on in front, and then hounds follow that, rather like a greyhound race. And that is one of the main activities, sort of sporting activities, at the South College. And it was an important, well, a feather in your cap if you whipped in or if you anything to do with the drag, or if you rode well in the drag. It was, it was a sort of mark of approval of a kind for amongst the sports. Some people turned up their noses at it, of course. Other sports people thought it was a feather in your cap if you did well riding to the hunt, to the drag. It was an imitation hunt.
Did you have to take an exam or anything at the end of this course in the Staff College?
I don't think you took a sort of set piece exam. I don't know. You got a report. I used to tease my wife by telling her that my report was, this officer had done quite well. He could have done better if he hadn't had to perform many of the duties normally carried out by the wife. It was actually written by somebody, about somebody, but it wasn't me, but I used to tell my wife that it was. It was one of my favorite stories to her. And she always said, oh, no, no, that was somebody else.
What happened to you after Staff College?
I went back to my regiment, who were then an infantry battalion in the what was then forming as the mobile armored formation. We had started off as that, as the infantry, as the mobile, carrier-borne, the mobile, carried infantry battalion of the, they call it? Not the armored division, something I can't remember. And it was commanded by Jack Collins at Tidworth. And we had been in that, at Tidworth, before I went to the Staff College, when we came back there from Khartoum. We were armed mainly with machine guns. And then that continued, and when I finished my time at the Staff College, the battalion was at Blackdown in the brigade, and still this sort of mobile brigade commanded by Archie Wavell. And I went back there as a company commander. And I was I was at Tidworth. I was at Tidworth, I think, until I went to take up my first staff job, which was what they call GSO weapon training, which was a sort of hybrid thing, not a G3 and not a G2. It was a sort of intermediate appointment. Well, at Talon Command in Salisbury, where I was responsible for the weapon training of the infantry throughout the command. And one of my main responsibilities was to run the annual rifle meeting on Bulford Ranges, which was quite an undertaking. And I did that, a chap called Cecil, first of all, Archie Montgomery Massingbird, he was later. He was commander-in-chief. And then he was succeeded by a chap called Cecil Romer. And my most best recollection of him, we had a big exercise up in Gloucestershire, a tactical exercise without troops. And in his summing up at the end, and this is what I remember about that particular exercise, he said, well, gentlemen, you know that conflict between senior commanders is one of the most damaging things that can happen in a campaign. And that was a good object lesson. And it's true.
You believe that?
Oh, yeah. Jealousies and disagreement and conflict or ambition or position between prima donnas in high command, it's a very, very damaging thing. I experienced it in practice later on in Italy as between Oliver Leese and Mark Clark. Oliver Leese commanding the 8th Army and Mark Clark, the American, commanding the 5th Army.
Yes, I must ask you about that when we get on to North Africa. That would be interesting to hear about.
So, yes, it was a very wise remark, and it is a fact, I think. Imposes a great responsibility and a difficult task on a commander-in-chief of an army group, for example, anything above the army level and above, of making sure that his immediately subordinate commanders are not influenced, unduly influenced by ambition or jealousy. And this is terribly important. Now it can happen. Or it happened all the time. I mean, well, look at what happened between Oliver Leese and Bill Slim in the Far East.
It's what happened there.
Well, I think Oliver Leese went out from Italy to take over command in the Far East, and he started perhaps trying not too much. He rather patterned himself on Monty, and he didn't get on with Bill Slim, and he started off by wanting to remove him from command. And of course that was stopped by Mountbatten. I don't know the detail, but there was a definite clash of personalities. That's what they call it. That's all the general description that's given to it. And you want to watch out for it very carefully. It damages, very damaging, because it has, it spreads down the line. And people become partisan. And that is very bad. You've got the supporters of one commander. One may be under the other, or maybe adjoining the other, maybe alongside each other. But a clash of personalities due through ambition or jealousy or whatever between high commanders is a very, very damaging, and it's a very difficult thing to avoid.